Hello, I'm Andrew Finney, and welcome to the Nurse Researcher Podcast, a podcast aimed at all nurses or health professionals interested in a research career. This podcast that will run fortnightly will feature nurse researchers from all levels, so PhD candidates, PhD students, postdocs and professors, and occasionally we'll throw in the odd bonus episode. We hope you enjoy it and find it really valuable. Do listen to the end where Eleanor and I do summarise the interviews, and if you get the chance, do click follow where you listen to your podcasts and you'll never miss an episode, and do give us a rating. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Nurse Researcher Podcast. And I am delighted to say that with us this week is Professor Sarah Ryan from the Heywood Hospital in Stoke-on-Trent in Staffordshire. So welcome, Sarah.
Thank you, Andrew. Lovely to be with you this afternoon.
It is. And I'll give the game away that we've known each other a long time. Probably too long to say how long it is, but I think I probably first met you in 1999. And I remember you being what I consider to be the first consultant nurse around the year 2000. Am I right in saying that?
Well done, what a memory. Exactly right, it's 2000. 2000 is the year.
2000, because that was when I qualified as a nurse, so that might make you feel old, actually.
Absolutely, yes. Thank you for sharing that. Yes, it does make me feel rather ancient.
So give us a little bit about your background, what your role is now, and then we'll take people back. But tell us what your role is now, Sarah.
Okay, so for the last 5 years, I've had the opportunity to become a professor in rheumatology nursing, which was a collaboration between a patient charity, the Heywood Foundation, and the trust that I work for, the Midlands Foundation University Hospital Trust. So it's a great opportunity. We haven't had a professor in nursing and rheumatology locally. So to actually combine the clinical role, the research role, and the education role under this kind of title has been great opportunity to, I think, show nurses what you can aspire to when you've had a predominantly clinical career like my own. I've never had a full-time academic contract. I've always worked within the NHS. And my background's been very much clinical, but I've always sort of had an interest in both patient and professional education and also the kind of clinical research. Why does this happen? Why doesn't this happen? What do patients need? And so I think it sort of all came together really nicely, being given this wonderful opportunity to develop the role and maybe hopefully get a bit of a model for a role so that in the future, the professor of nursing post won't be such a rarity, but will be a normal kind of development of clinical academic practice for people to aspire to.
Yeah. And before I take you back to the beginnings of how you became a nurse, because I think that's a lovely starting point for people. But if I think back to the year 2000 and seeing you as a consultant nurse, and you know, it's over 20 years, you're really a very trailblazing clinical academic before we came about with that term. Would you agree?
I suppose I've never thought of it in those sort of terms before, Andrew. I've just sort of had lovely opportunities that have come along, which have kind of mirrored where I'm going clinically. I suppose when the nurse consultant post first came out, the main rationale behind that was to keep senior clinical nurses in clinical practice, because prior to that, the route of progression was either education or research solely. And so it kind of was where I was at. I was wanting to stay in clinical, but equally I was wanting some protected time to try and develop education primarily at that point. And when I became a nurse consultant, I made the decision to really concentrate on developing education provision and developing a master's program in rheumatology for nurses. And then it expanded appropriately to include all health professionals as well. And when I became that nurse consultant, it was the first time I had one designated day a week to not be in clinical practice. So that was huge, because before, as lots of nurses do, you balance all these balls. You try and do a bit of education. You might try and do a bit of maybe audit and service evaluation. But it's very hard to fit that in when 80% plus 90% of your role is delivering clinical care in what is and continues to be very busy clinical services.
Yeah. Now, I might take you back shortly about how you kept that protected and how that came about, but I'm going to take you right back to what should be the opening question for most people. And I don't know this about you, Sarah, despite the fact of being that young staff nurse back in the year 2000. I don't know where you started. So how did you become a nurse?
Yeah, so I actually did my training back in the 1980s. Which is so far back now. It's horrible to think that far back. The careers advice I got at school, you were a woman, they were able to recognise that, which was a helpful start. And then you were either advised in a 5-minute interview to either go into teaching or nursing. And that was the only advice you got at that time. So I went into nursing, and it was great because it was an occupational kind of recognition that you came out with when you did your training. It didn't have any academic weighting, but it was very much a practice orientated course. You did your 6 weeks on placement, usually in a ward environment in those days. Then you had 2 weeks in what was classed school, where you did some of the theory. So there was a lot of kind of practical learning and, you know, being with patients, which was a great way to kind of develop your communication skills and to try and understand the needs of the patients. So it was in Harrogate, and it was a great experience. You were with the same group of people on the ward. You got close friendships, which was very supportive when you're learning, you know, as a student as well. So there was, a lot of merit in that. I really sort of enjoyed it. It was broad spectrum training. So you sort of sampled everything, really, to, you know, it sort of enriched the process. And at that particular time, I was really wanted to go into women's health and go into sort of gynecological nursing, but got an opportunity to sort of move into rheumatology. But it's very fond memories of training, and, you know, in that particular model.
Yeah. And so I would think of you always as being, as long as I've known you, you've been like the clinical academic. And like I said earlier, that we probably didn't have that title then. But in that move into rheumatology, what came first, the clinical or the academic, or did they come together at the same time?
Yeah, I think it was always the clinical. That was sort of what I was sort of versed in. And I did my first sort of toe in the water of research when I did my BSc when I was a staff nurse. And that got me interested in thinking, actually, it's very useful to learn different methods to address clinical questions as they come along. But I think very much, I always thought of myself as the clinician, as the nurse, and that the research side ran along it. So most of the research projects I've been involved with, or I've been fortunate enough to lead, have come from clinical questions that have arisen due to the work that I was doing with patients. So it's all been clinically driven and come from the patients themselves. So I think very much, and I still see myself very much as, you know, a clinical person who does some research.
Yeah, but I suppose people often talk about where they've got dual roles now. They should say, well, wear two hats. But actually yours has always seemed like it's one for you, despite the fact you've got the clinical and the academic.
Yeah, absolutely. I do see it as one role. And I think, you know, if you're doing clinical research, you obviously need the experience of understanding what the clinical questions are, what it's like to be a patient, what are the important questions for patients, because obviously the purpose of nursing is to improve the quality of care, to improve the experiences for nurses. So you have to understand that from the people who are living that experience, which is the patients. So that has always been the kind of drive and has informed the research. So I suppose, you know, if you were describing a nursing role, you want it, don't you? I suppose if you're describing the ideal model, to have some clinical input, whether that's direct or not direct, whether to have some education in it, you know, have some research, because we want to provide evidence-based care. Mm. And there's loads of questions in nursing that are very tricky to answer, that, you know, that aren't the easiest puzzles to always address, but they're important to us, and they're important to, you know, to the profession. And as we, you know, grow and get more of an evidence base in our profession, then we want it to inform clinical practice, because if, research isn't going to lead to any development of practice. One argues why you would probably engage in it in the first place if it wasn't for some kind of benefit, or to increase our understanding, or to support nursing development with maybe their training needs.
Yeah, absolutely. And with what you're saying there, how does that link back to the start of the PhD? So no doubt you had what perhaps you didn't consider the research question at that time, but did a clinical question become your PhD?
Yes, it did. So I'd started off as a ward sister in Harrogate. I moved down and took a clinical nurse specialist role. And what I soon discovered was when the difference between working on the ward as a ward sister and then being a clinical nurse specialist was vast. And I was running follow-up clinics for people with rheumatoid arthritis. And as I was getting engaged in that work, it led me to think, what skills do patients need to help them cope with their condition? So, I mean, but just for the audience, a condition like rheumatoid arthritis is not curable. We can reduce and suppress the inflammation process, but people are still having to live with the daily, sometimes pain, the stiffness, the swollen joints, the impact on their social or occupational role. And so I'd have patients coming into clinic that were well physically, but were struggling to cope with some of the symptoms or the impact. And when I sort of went to the literature to sort of find out how could we help support patients to manage these symptoms, to live well with rheumatoid arthritis and to optimize their functioning, there wasn't a lot of information from the patient's perspective. So there was lots written to say the physio could do this, the OT could do this, the nurse could do this, but it was coming more from professional bodies rather from the patients themselves, which led me then to think, well, I need to do some kind of interviews or focus groups with patients where I can actually try and understand their experience and see if there's any commonalities that we can then use to develop our service. So I was the first clinical nurse specialist locally in Stoke. And so I was really keen to develop the service. So I thought, great, if I could combine my PhD and hope that the findings then would inform some of the service delivery. So instead of it just being an academic piece of work, which obviously has merit in itself, but it could also then inform local services for people as well.
Yeah. And reflective of the time, am I right in thinking you had medical supervisors rather than nurse supervisors? Because there probably wasn't nurse supervisors available to you at that time.
No, that was right. So I had a nurse supervisor, Professor Sally Kendall, who worked for the University of Buckinghamshire. Her background was in chronic illness. So she was very inspirational to me. She understood completely that the need to understand the patient experience and had done a lot of work in that. So it was great to actually find somebody that had sort of similar ideas and aspirations. And like I say, it was very motivational to me. But locally, you're right, that there wasn't the nursing support available. So one of the consultants that I worked with, Pete Dawes, very kindly threw his hat sort of into the room and said that he was prepared to, to give it a go without having a huge amount of experience in what we would term qualitative, research, understanding exploring the experience of patients. But again, he was very enthusiastic. He wanted nurses to develop. He wanted to do everything that he could to support all the nurses within the team, to give them their own sort of opportunities. So I was lucky that I found myself in a culture that was very much to do, wanted to support, wanted people to develop, and were very happy and generous to give their time to support. And actually having somebody that wasn't versed in qualitative was really helpful, because Pete would always ask the question, but why does that matter? Why does the opinions of people matter? What are you going to do with it? It's not generalizable. What's the value? What's the worth? So I almost had my Viva question sorted out on day one with Pete actually asking me them all before coming to the end, asked in a very supportive way as well. He generally wanted to try and understand the world I was getting immersed in as well. So that kind of that support was great.
And was it a steep learning curve for you to do the PhD?
I think because I chose an area I was really interested in, my master's degree had sort of prepared me a little bit for it, and so I don't think it. What it was, I suppose, the challenge was fitting it in a busy clinical role. So I was setting up, with the support of the team around me, a clinical nursing service within rheumatology and putting a lot of energy in that. So it was the challenges as a lot of us face. It was juggling all those different balls, really, you know, doing the clinical service. And I think because I had such great support from Sally Kendall, so I would literally send a draft of something, and within 48 hours, it would be back covered completely with sort of red pen and everything, which I knew then that she'd read every word. I mean, if you get something back with loads of comments on, it's always positive because somebody's read it rather than getting something back with maybe one comment on. So I think it was just the chat. I wanted to do it in the shortest possible time, which for a PhD at that time, a part-time PhD, was about 4 years. And I was determined I just wanted to do it in that time so that I could then start developing the service. So the sort of that really sort of gave me something to aim for. Let's get it done as soon as you can, in a way, so that you can use the results and the experience to start developing other things.
That's really positive to hear, isn't it? Because I think there's this view, and I say I think, I know from speaking to students and speaking to nurses still today, that there's this fear that research or a PhD is what other people do, and there's very few people in nursing that would do this. But actually, what you've demonstrated there is that because you didn't know of the boundaries, because now we might say 4 days a week to do it over 4 years, 5 days a week to do it over 3 years. Actually, if it's something that you're passionate about and something that you can fit in with a percentage of your career, you can still be quite effective in a short period of time. Because now people would be thinking, wow, Sarah did that PhD in a small element of time over 4 years. Seems like quite a big achievement.
I think it just helps you to keep focused. You know, I think sometimes you're better thinking, right, I'm going to give my thinking about what I found has always been really helpful is trying to think about what are my short term goals professionally, medium term and long term goals. So I sort of put it into all of that. I didn't think of, oh, I'm just doing a PhD in isolation. I thought the PhD is part of my role. If I can get it in this period of time and it fits in with other goals, that means I can then use energy to do some of the other things I enjoy as well. So although a PhD for anyone doing it is a big commitment, you know, it can take a lot of time. I think if people clinical nurses are wanting to do PhD, well, I suppose for anybody, it's got to be something you're interested in, something you see the value of because you're putting so much time and energy. It's trying to not make it bigger than it is and not make it smaller than it is, but to think that, you know, if it can fit into your role, then it is part of your role to actually do, and not something that's too big or unachievable.
And I've always, you'll be pleased to hear, Sarah, as a qualitative researcher, I've got a sort of topic guide for myself for these interviews, so you'll be proud of me in that sense. But I'm going off topic a little bit now, because I usually say to people, has it enhanced your career to some extent? And you know that when people are suddenly called professor and they're in university, but you're in the clinical workplace and have always remained there, despite the fact you've had affiliations and associations with universities to do what you've needed to do. So reversing that question a little bit for you, you didn't have to do the PhD to have been clinical nurse specialist or consultant nurse. So what do you think would have been differently in your career had you not have done the PhD? What do you think it's enhanced in the way that only this has been achieved because I've developed a research career?
I think when you do a PhD, you learn a lot. You learn about ethics, you learn about putting a research proposal together. It gives you a feel for what the real world of research could be like. So I think it is a great training for people who then think, yes, I'm going to go into research. So I suppose if I hadn't have done that, I would have had to have needed maybe to look for how to get that skill set another way if I was then wanting to put grants together or get money to do meaningful research. But to actually do it as an academic exercise with the supervision and learning from all that creative, supportive questioning you get from your supervisors starts to develop your own kind of questioning mind. I think I grew up in a nursing world where nurses didn't challenge too much. Nurses were more accepting of what things were happening, that there just wasn't that sort of culture, whereas we've changed a lot of that. And I think when you do things like PhD, it increases your own confidence. You start to then think about what questions are important. You learn from the questions people ask you. So even if you don't understand the questions, you think to yourself, why is that important? Why is somebody asking me that question? That must have some meaning, which then leads you to go on and find out a little bit more about it. So I think a PhD is a great learning. It's almost like doing it at the first part of your apprenticeship to gain some of the skills and knowledge and insight when you think of all the public engagement and everything that you need to put together a good research proposal. It teaches you a lot of that, but in a very supportive environment where you can not make mistakes, but where you can sort of just make it apparent that you don't understand why somebody thinks that is important, and you can learn a lot from it. So hopefully, as you come out towards the end of your PhD, you're a completely different person in terms of the questions you would ask about research and almost how you would appraise research yourself and the robustness of the process as well. So it was a great learning experience. I didn't think of that perhaps at the time when I was doing transcribing 40 interviews on a weekend on an old-fashioned machine because we didn't have transcription services at that time. But, you know, looking at the whole experience, you know, it was a great opportunity. And one of the other things from it, it was one of the first nurses to be given the research money from, I can't remember what versus arthritis would have been called in those days, but before it developed into that organisation. That, you know, to be a nurse, I mean, interview, they kept thinking I was a physiotherapist because I hadn't given nurses any money before. So actually to show to organisations as well that do support health professionals to do research, you know, a nurse is willing to give this a go. A nurse has got the support of the, you know, the organisation. And, you know, I always have to be very, very thankful for the trusts that I've worked with and the NHS organisations that have supported me to do that, because they could have said, listen, you're not employed to do that. You've got a busy clinical job. You've not chosen to go into research. You know, we can't support you. But as you know, when you're putting these things together, you need to show all your organisational support, et cetera, of the culture you work in. So, you know, actually working in an organisation where the managers have always been very supportive of development has obviously helped me a lot to have the opportunities that I've had.
Yeah, and I think I can remember what you're talking about there, but that was that the arthritis research campaign at the time?
Oh, well done, you see, a younger mind, better memory. That's what I'm going to put that on. The older mind, the brain's full of lots of other things in there. But yes, it was. Yes, yeah. I could picture the symbol, but not yes.
Yeah, yeah, ARC. We used to call it ARC, hadn't we?
With the ARC leaflets and everything.
Yeah, yeah, I do recall it now. I don't know if it's a younger brain or it's just that I'm older than we perhaps remember. It's one or the other, but I do remember the arthritis research campaign.
Yeah.
With your career highlights, I mean, I think out from the outside looking in, because we've never sort of worked together in the same institution since the early 2000s, but I've known you over that time. So if I was talking about your career highlights, I'd be thinking the people you've developed, the careers that you've helped and really empowered. I'd be thinking about the educational achievements that you've had with your developing master's courses that have become international. But for you, what would be your research highlights?
Interesting question.
You see how I didn't give you the way out and going into education?
Yes, I would have gone more into education.
Yes. I want you to pin you down into the
which probably shows my heart is more in the education and everything.
Or I'm becoming Paxman. You never know.
No, it could be a combination of that. I suppose my research highlights is I couldn't pick one particular study that I've done where I thought, gosh, that is a highlight. I think all of the studies that I've led have been patients' experiences, and I've just been so grateful for the opportunity that patients are so generous with their time to share their experiences, to help me get into their world and to help me understand what it is we've been looking at. I mean, one of the more recent ones has been looking at the treatment burden that patients with conditions like rheumatoid arthritis face when they have to attend regularly for their drug monitoring, and how that impacts on having time out of work, how it impacts on their other aspects of that role. And it kind of brought it home to me. It's easy to forget those things when we say to people, we're going to start on a drug, it can reduce the inflammation, can help you feel better. We sometimes forget to just check with patients and say, are you all right with all of this? Are you going to be able to go for those blood tests? How is that going to be able to impact on your lifestyle? So that's something, that bit of research certainly changed my own consultation skills to ensure that when I am working with a patient, I'm checking out that treatment we've agreed on, that they're actually going to be able to manage, and how much of a burden is it actually going to be? Yeah. And the fact that we have almost one rule for everyone. So a fit, healthy person on a drug has to have their blood test done as often as somebody with lots of comorbidities and higher risks. And we're just looking at this as a kind of profession to see if we can actually make it more stratified, to actually individualize it and make it more person-centered. So that kind of a research always has an impact on me. But there hasn't been one particular highlight. Mm-hmm. I don't suppose I've done that enough research to have a kind of highlights, Andrew. It was kind of it was kind of you to presume I have.
Yeah, and I do also know how modest you are as well, Sarah, so I might not let you get away with that. There's lots of highlights. And what we do in these podcasts is we do offer you the opportunity as the interviewee to send me some of the links to some of the research you're most proud of, and I'll put that into the podcast link as well. So for the listener, they will know that some of the work that you want to promote will be on the podcast as well. So we'll let you do that. But I'm going to flip the question around a little bit. If you had your time again, we can go back as far as you like. But if we went back to the start of your research journey, would you do anything differently?
I don't think I would. Making my journey sound, very easy. And in some ways it has been very easy. And it's been easy because I've been immersed in cultures that have been supportive and have wanted to develop me and have wanted to invest in me. So I haven't had any sort of particular challenges or obstacles to overcome. I mean, when I sort of moved down from in Harrogate, I was doing my master's in ethics. And when I came down to Stoke, they said, you can't carry on doing a master's in ethics. You need to do, a master's that's more applicable to you. And I fully agreed with that. But in terms of research, because I've always, I think that the secret is surround yourself with good people, and surround yourself with people whose opinion matters to you. You'll always get some opinions where people might be doubtful of your work or doubtful of your ability. But you need to think to yourself, are they the opinions that matter to me? The people who you value, who you respect, who inspire you, it's those opinions that you want. And I've always had excellent mentorships throughout. So Jackie Hill, who was the first sort of clinical nurse specialist in rheumatology, who published the seminal paper on follow-up care in rheumatology clinics, was one of my original mentors. And I've had different mentors at different times. And really, my research career took off because I was fortunate enough to work with Professor Andy Hassell, who people might know used to be head of the medical school before he retired and was a consultant rheumatologist. And he also encouraged me and helped me to look at where I wanted to focus my research on. I get great support now from people like, you know, Professor Sam Hyder and Zoe Paskins and just highlighted a few people, don't want to offend anybody I haven't mentioned in that as well. But I think, you know, seeking judgment from others, being open to and receptive to what people are offering you, even if you sometimes can't see the value of it first yourself, you know, it provides that great support. And I don't think I would have, I've enjoyed every part of my journey, clinically, educationally, and research-wise. And I think because I've had that enjoyment, I probably wouldn't change it. And yeah. I think making the most of opportunities when they come along, you know, it can be a really valuable experience. You know, maybe don't regret what hasn't occurred or what could be done differently, because you can learn from the past, but you can only move forward. So I think for anybody thinking about a research career, it's good to go and speak to those people that matter to you, who will be generous enough to give their times and opinion, and may help you to map out a course, to look where you're going, how you're going to get there in your journey, what you need to do, where it will help inform your own journey. You know, no man is the island kind of thing. Research doesn't happen anymore in little individual pocket. It's part of a team, you know, and we need to get those teams around people to support and identify inspiring nurse researchers of the future, and invest in them by giving them time, structure, and guidance.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think with the Chief Nursing Officer's strategy and the way NHS England are thinking, I think that's the idea now, that we build that journey for people, that clinical academic role. So you were ahead of the game with this, and I always thought as a bit of a trailblazer, and I didn't have a title for what I'd seen you do until people started to talk about the clinical academic. But I'm going to ask you about how your professorship came about, and I'll let you into a little secret, as you're the only person I've ever heard this said about. But when you got your chair, I remember people saying, Sarah Ryan's become a professor, long overdue. And that, so was it harder to come about because you were clinical rather than an academic institution? Because I've never heard that of anybody else, but people probably assumed you were a professor before you were one.
I think it's very nice to hear that people thought that, Andrew. Very nice indeed. I think it is harder clinically, because I don't think we've got a model or a pathway or a route for it. So I had quite a few opportunities to get more embedded within universities. And actually, when you asked that previous question about looking back, maybe that's something I should have been a little bit more canny about. And I was so worried of losing the clinical identity that I decided not to go for lots of opportunities I had to have sort of joint contracts with university and NHS. I just wanted to keep with patients and keep the NHS. But I think actually, if you were saying, if you learned something, looking back, I might have thought, is it possible what I want to do with having the university connection as well, which I think it would have been. But I was a bit sort of blinkered in that and thought that I didn't want to lose that sort of clinical or get too involved in kind of university. So I think it was harder clinically and not having that academic affiliation. So I've been lucky enough to have honorary contracts with the School of Nursing and Midwifery at Keele, but it has been sort of honorary contracts. So I think that maybe it can take longer, but maybe, you know, all the more sweeter for it. There's no rush to get to these sort of things, and really nice in a way that it came via a patient charity group in a way, and the very innovative trust that I work with at the moment. So, but I think it probably did take longer, and hopefully, if we can develop a clearer pathway for the clinical academic, which I'm sure we'll have, it needs to be wide enough and enough variety that it's not so insular that it excludes people. We need to think of routes that can be a mixture rather than just one, to make it more inclusive, to make sure we're not missing nurses that have got the ability to be leading the profession as well.
Yeah, and I think as I get to my final question, Sarah, I think you've probably already started your answer to that, because you've talked about making sure you've got that academic alignment to sort of progress quicker if that's what's needed. But my last question on this podcast is always, what advice would you give to others? So it's probably, if you're thinking about the clinical academic now, you don't have to have done the 10 years and become a ward manager and then achieve this and then done that. If you've got the right ability, if you're naturally academic, you could go straight from qualifying to doing research, or you can have a 25-year career and then go into research. But either way, no matter what end of the spectrum you might be to do that, what would be your advice to the aspiring clinical academic?
Yeah, I think one of the things we need to do is earlier on in people's career pathway is to introduce them to research in whatever format that might be. And I can see a time perhaps because it's so difficult to attract nurses and retain nurses in, that we could have a situation where contracts in the future for new nurses were X amount of days clinical and X amount of days research anyway. Mm. And that could become the new norm, the new kind of model, which would actually send the message that the two are integrated and separated. And I think it's that integration which is really important to do, and for people to try and get that sort of interest in research early on, because I think sometimes when we think of the sort of advanced nurse practitioner role, even if I can get it out, one of the four pillars of that is research. Mm. But people that sometimes come into that role have the advanced clinical skills, but no experience of research at all, and then find it very difficult to try and get into that research world. So I think somehow, if we're looking at a clinical academic post, how can we keep the two going in tandem at a much earlier stage in somebody's career? Like you said, we don't have to sort of go from, you know, you've got to be assistant ward manager and then you go to X. You know, we need to have lots of different routes in so that people that are inquisitive show an interest, any kind of passion or desire for research, and want to address clinical questions, that we can do that at a much earlier stage in the career. And I think that will only come if we change some of the structure of posts when we get nurses in straight away, that they are not all solely clinical, that there is a research element or a professional development time within that role, that we can get the interest at an early age.
A brilliant bit of guidance for us there, Sarah, and a wonderful way to end this episode. So, Sarah Ryan, Professor Sarah Ryan, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Very enjoyable.
Hello, and welcome back to the Nurse Researcher Podcast. Here we are following episode 6, I think, 5, 6, episode 5, perhaps, Sarah Ryan, and somebody that I know, I've known since I was a newly qualified staff nurse. So it was interesting to think back when I was talking to Sarah Ryan. She's Professor Sarah Ryan of the Heywood Hospital in North Staffordshire. And I remember qualifying as a nurse and going onto a rheumatology ward, and they'd got this consultant nurse, and I'd never heard of it. And I believe it to be the first. But fascinating story, and one that I followed over the years, because she was a clinical supervisor to my PhD. She wasn't an academic supervisor. She was a clinical supervisor, and somebody that I've really looked up to and has been a real sort of mentor and support for a lot of people over the years. She seems to be one of those professors that's developed or really, really helped a lot of people along the way. That's really been her drive, and really patients first. And her colleagues, you know, have all benefited from working with Sarah or for Sarah over the years. What was your take on what was a very clinical professorship?
Yeah, I mean, what an amazing achievement to become the first nurse consultant. She really has carved the path for many others, hasn't she? I think Sarah's interview, you could really sense her passion and her clinical expertise around patients with rheumatoid arthritis really came through. You know, she gave a really clear understanding of what led her to her research. and to be the first clinical specialist. It did make me chuckle a little bit, thinking about what she said about the careers advice she was given at school. As a female, you either go into nursing or teaching. And I thought, wow, what a long way we have come, which is good. But interesting to hear that. But yeah, the skills, she was very clear about the skills that people need to cope with their condition, their rheumatoid arthritis. And she also spoke again about how important it was to have fantastic supervisors. But also she had a medical supervisor as well as a nurse supervisor, didn't she? Mm. And really highlighted that as being important as well. And I do agree with her. I think I'm fortunate to have a multidisciplinary team, supervisory team as well. She mentioned as well the challenge of fitting in a PhD in a busy role, but she sounded so calm throughout the interview. And I thought, wow, she sounds like she would have been so calm throughout the whole journey. You know, made it sound quite easy, really. But she did speak about, you know, how you have to juggle the roles, and again mentioned the support that you need to be able to do that. And also spoke about the red pen and the feedback, I think, that Professor Catherine Evans had mentioned before. But she spoke about it so positively too, you know, saying, you know, at least you know they have read what you've written. She offered some great tips too, I think. She spoke about thinking about developing your career with short-term, medium-term and long-term goals. And she really obviously thought about how her PhD was going to fit into part of her role, but she also seemed to offer, I thought, what was a really balanced view of that. So it's quite interesting to hear her journey. And I did wonder, but she did, I don't think she mentioned it, did she, how many days she spent on her PhD and how many days she spent working clinically. But she did it, you know, and in four years as well. So whatever she did, she made it work. And you know, really offered a really whole holistic view of what the PhD offers. You know, like we were speaking before, it's not just the writing, is it? It's the ethics, working up an ethics proposal. It's the real world out there. It's learning the IT skills. It's learning all the different software you need to use. There's a lot to learn, isn't there? So I found it really interesting. And also thinking about, you know, the fact that she said she grew up in a nursing world where nurses didn't really challenge too much. Nurses didn't question, which has changed obviously a lot.
I mean, she, without meeting her and without seeing her, you've described her very, very cleverly there in one word as calm. That is what she is, actually. She gave a wonderful inaugural lecture. And again, perhaps I could find the link and share it at the end of this podcast. It was, in fact, not only was it wonderful, it was hilarious. She was really funny, really dry, and telling that story of the difficulties, you know, in the 80s as trying to with somebody that's career developing, a woman at that time. And even the talk about sort of going to rheumatology is something that was really slow and relaxed, and there wouldn't be a lot for you to do there. You know, that was advice that somebody gave to her, and she sort of put up the slide of this tranquil setting to say, this is what I thought I was coming to. But she did, I think what Sarah did instantly when she got to the Hayward Hospital was not demand the respect, but very quickly earn the respect of the rheumatologists, the consultants, and they saw what she was capable of, and they wanted to change the way that rheumatology outpatients were managed, really. And she changed that for them. So she developed a much different service that became very nurse-led and drew people down to do, drew nurses to do drug monitoring and blood monitoring of patients that are taking cytotoxic medication. So it was very forward-thinking for the time. And through the master's degree, which she developed, she's developed international nurses. So even though she sort of went very much, she was pushed the education, didn't she, as much as the research that she's done. That master's degree in rheumatology was the first in the world. So people have come from all around the world to do that master's degree and then gone to some very sort of like niche countries, very small countries, and been able to develop a rheumatology service in a country for the first time, based on Sarah's master's and that pathway that she's done. She always undersold herself a little bit. And I think what I tried to pick up on, and I only thought it before the interview, I thought, actually, she was a clinical academic before we had the term clinical academic. So she's done it her way, and she'd make a great case study, wouldn't she? But one thing she didn't talk about, and I was looking at the clock thinking, I always try and keep the episodes to around 30 minutes, and I thought it was going so well, I didn't want to interrupt, but What she also didn't mention is she started her own journal.
Oh, right. Now, okay.
So what she did probably 10, 15 years ago is she recognized that sometimes as a first paper for nurses, it's hard to get into an academic journal. So she, I think it was Wiley she went to or Blackwell Publishing or something like that. But she does tell the story in the inaugural lecture, actually. But the journal Musculoskeletal Care is hers. It's been going for a number of years now. I've published in it. And she saw it as something where if you wanted your first paper from your PhD and you were in that musculoskeletal field, that was where to go. But actually, it's developed beyond that. I'm now a sort of associate editor of the journal, and I do review for that journal. And it all came from her. It was a new musculoskeletal journal where she felt nurses and AHPs could really start to get a feel for how to write for publications. So felt like I needed to mention that because she hasn't done that. You know, there's that many things that she's done. She perhaps overlooked that a little bit in the interview.
Yes. So humble in her interview, clearly, wasn't she? Mm. But I think that's probably the case for a lot of, the professors that you've interviewed so far. They probably have achieved so much that it's actually quite difficult to get it all into the space of an interview, isn't it? But one thing you did mention was respect. And I thought the same thing, actually, when she spoke about her interview with, was it Arthritis Research Campaign, and they kept thinking she was a physio. It really demonstrates, you know, where we've come as a profession. There's still a way to go. But I thought, you know, throughout what she's told us during this story, I thought she must have really gained an awful lot of respect as maybe one of the first clinical academic researchers to get to where she got to. She's obviously worked very, very hard to do that, but found a way to do that. You know, and I think one of the things I was thinking as well is that she spoke about pathways towards the end of the interview and having a mixture of routes to get there. Mm. And clearly she feels strongly because she kind of sounds like had to carve her own route like a lot of people do, don't they? Mm. But I think, you know, that is really important, isn't it? And that requires flexibility within organizations, to be able to do that really. Yeah. So she's really quite inspirational with what she's achieved.
And I think we've been very academic with the first three or four interviews. People have gone into academia and they've felt they've had to do that. And Sarah's always had a foot in academia, but never left practice. So she's never actually come and been a lecturer or stepped out of the hospital setting. She's always made sure that that's firmly where she's placed and she gets involved. She'll have an honorary contract with the university. So again, one of those things where you think, you know, you have to admire her for doing that. Patients are what she really is, her main focus, and she's stayed where they are. Really, she hasn't moved out to do research. She's been able to do research where she is, and a lot of people, if I'm going to say our generation, have struggled to do that. You know, you've had to go into academia solidly and move fully into it to get into research, but she's been able to gain the funding and do the work that she's needed to do while staying in that clinical role.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to speak to her again, actually, wouldn't it, to find out exactly how, you know, how she did that. But I imagine, you know, she'd carved such a path of respect and obviously followed through on everything that she'd done as well. So I'm sure with that, you know, people will then believe that actually this person says what they're going to do, which I think probably helps, doesn't it? But yeah, incredible. And I loved at the end what she said about introducing nurses early, which, you know, there's a lot of effort being put into that at the moment, isn't there, with the NIHR Insight Programme and NHS England as well. But, you know, she really highlighted, you know, how important it is to be raising awareness and getting nurses at the early stages of their career involved in research. And interesting what she said as well about integrating, you know, perhaps doing X amount of days clinical and X amount of days of research in making it more routine as part of your development. But great interview, really interesting to hear her story.
Yeah, and a slightly different story of the first four or five, so it's been interesting to do that. But yeah, she's in what is a very niche area, rheumatology. Everybody knows everybody, but everybody really does know Sarah and has huge admiration and respect for her, and I think that comes across in the interview. You understand why.
Absolutely. And one other thing I think she mentioned was surround yourself with good people and those whose opinions matter to you as well.
Clearly
a great tip.
Yeah, good tip. Absolutely. So I think that perhaps draws that one to a close. I think that's probably where we are. So thanks for listening again, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.